Okay, we're in chapter 25 of Matthew, and this is a parable that must be seen in its context. Not that they haven't all been very contextual, but this one in particular, this one is particularly dependent upon its context. And its context begins in chapter 24, and it is known as the Olivet Discourse. And the Olivet Discourse is in response to questions asked of Jesus, going all the way back to verse number 1, when he says, as he leaves the temple, he's going away. His disciples come to the point to point out to him the buildings of the temple, but he answered them, "You see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there will not be here left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." That raises questions in the mind of the disciples, and so they ask some questions, and the remainder of chapter 24 is essentially Jesus addressing the questions. And the questions tell us in verse 3 of chapter 24, "When will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the close of the age?" So their questions were pertaining to the subject of eschatology. How's the end of this age going to pan out? When is it going to be? What's it going to be like? What are the signs of it? And when will that take place? So, in answering those questions, Jesus addresses a number of eschatological things, but he's basically answering those questions. That's what he's doing. And as he begins chapter 25, or as Matthew begins chapter 25, it is a continuation. Or in other words, it's now teaching coming out of his answering those questions. So there is a connection, a tie. In fact, in verse 25, or chapter 25, verse 1, the word is then. How many of you have a translation? That's the very first word, then. The Greek word there is tate. And it literally is weaving what follows with what preceded. And so he says, then, based upon what I've told you, then, future tense, then, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. By the way, as we plow through this, because we're not treating Matthew's gospel verse by verse and so on and so forth, it's going to be necessary a little bit to kind of let you see how this ties in with what he's already done. But he has already taught in 2 consecutive lesson-type events in chapter 24 these same words. If you go back to verse 36 of chapter 24, you see him saying the answer to the last question. "But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, not the Son, but the Father only." And then he uses a comparison. "As were the days of Noah, so will the coming of the Son of Man." So will be the coming of the Son of Man. "For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away, so will the coming of the Son of Man." So will be the coming of the Son of Man. Then, he's talking about then, in the end of the age. "Then 2 men will be in the field. One will be taken, one will be left. 2 women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and one left." Now, scholars across a wide array of belief systems, denominations, backgrounds, if you were, will look at the 24th chapter of Matthew's gospel, and they will interpret it based upon, to a large degree, what their belief system is, their presuppositions. If they do not believe that anything is prophetic in the New Testament, then they will interpret the 24th chapter in that way. But oddly enough, there's no way to interpret the 24th chapter where it's not somewhat futuristic, because the questions are so clearly futuristic. So many commentators, many scholars, interpret the 24th chapter of Matthew as if it was predicting the fall of Jerusalem that occurred sometime around, occurred 70 AD. And it has a point of, issue. That's only a part of the history that we have to look back through to get to the 24th chapter of Matthew. There were other issues. There were other things. And why many commentators see this as being prophetic of the fall of Jerusalem is because of what Jesus says when he says, speaking of the temple, look, do you see? Well, what you're looking at, there won't be one stone left upon another stone. Speaking of the temple. This is the temple that was Herod's temple. It took 40 years to build. It was still in the building process. Even as Jesus walked around it, it was a massive edifice. It was the pride of Israel. It was the remake, only significantly grander, that's a word, than Solomon's temple. And it ends up being destroyed in 70 AD by Rome. And that becomes a very key component in Israel's history. So I'm not here tonight to address Matthew 24 and whether or not it was. I don't think that's what it's about. I don't think he's addressing the fall of Jerusalem and the crumbling of the temple. That's humbly not what I think. And the reason I don't think that is because that's not what he was asked. He was asked about something very specific. If he was referring to the fall of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple, then he did not answer their questions, because their questions were pertaining to the end, the eschaton, the last of this age, whatever that age may have been. What will be the last of it? Now there's a possibility, I'm not saying this is it, but there's a possibility that Jesus was answering something they didn't know they were asking. Maybe they didn't know they were asking about this age in the way Jesus meant this age. If this age was the age in which the Jews were the target of God's work of redemption, then in essence, that age was moving by. Because as Israel rejects Jesus, what happens? The gospel goes to the Gentiles. And that is a possibility. But I would say that's only a thin possibility. It appears that they are asking him a specific question, knowing that even in Jewish theology, there was an eschatology. There was an end of all things. And of course, in their mind, that end of all things had to do with the kingdom being like they envisioned the kingdom of David under David's reign, when it was a unified and a powerful and a wealthy kingdom, and when it was not subservient for that brief period of time to any other kingdom. But remember in Matthew's gospel that his theme, his approach, has been to present the kingdom of heaven. So he is intentionally presenting this. And remember, every parable in the 13th chapter of Matthew, every parable had to do with the kingdom of heaven. You recall that? That was just the way Jesus preached, and it was the way Matthew noted his preaching. And he takes it up again in the 25th chapter, right in the middle of answering the questions that the disciples had asked. So that is where we turn. Then the kingdom of heaven, then, that is, in the eschaton, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps, and the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answered, saying, "Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But, by the way, that word "but" is 2 words in the original language. It's ha day. It is an absolute. It is an absolute. Not, "oh, this is a little bit of a problem," but an absolute. It's an absolute "but." This is something we're not going to get around. But he answered. And he used the term that Matthew frequently uses. "Truly, I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour." So it is in that regard that we can see this is tied back to what he has been teaching in the 24th chapter, known as the Olivet Discourse. It's a further announcement of when the end of this age is coming. No one knows the hour. And he's just now used this parabolic illustration to show how utterly important it is that we remain watchful and prepared. So I want us to look at this parable and see if we can't break it down a little bit. I'm going to look at it from 2 standpoints. Number 1 is the analysis of the parable, and the second is the application of the parable. Because regardless of how you interpret this parable, whether you interpret it as speaking relative to the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, or whether you interpret it as more futuristic, being the actual end of the age that the Jews knew and everybody knew that this was the age of humanity, the age after the creation. It has to be applied. It has to be able to be applied to us. Otherwise, there's no significance in the meaning. What difference does it make what it means if there's no application of it? I'm not just talking in theory here, folks. I'm talking in a very serious vein. Why did God give us His Word? Why did God give us His Word? That we might grow in the same sort of way Jesus grew, in wisdom and stature, in favor with God and man. His Word is a lamp, as the psalmist said, unto my feet, a light unto my path. I will hide its words in my heart. Why? That I might not sin against you. So His Word comes with the intention of application. If you understand the meaning of the word, but you don't have an application of that word, then you don't understand the meaning of that word. It's that simple. There must be an application or there is no understanding. Now, not every application is right, just like not every interpretation is right. But the applications or the significance of a passage while the significance is rooted in the meaning. You can't have a significance, you can't have an application that is not rooted in the meaning. The meaning is only one. God only means one thing when he says it. He doesn't mean 15 things. Sometimes in our Sunday school classes, we'll say, what does this mean to you? That really doesn't matter, folks. It really doesn't matter what it means to you. What it matters is what it means. What did God mean by it? That's what matters. But here's where what it means to you does matter. How do you apply it in your life? It must be rooted in the meaning, but in the placement and in the application of it within your life, there might be variance. In other words, the meaning never changes, but the significance of it may change from person to person, from life to life, from country to country, from age to age. The meaning never changes, but the significance or the application of it may. So let's look at it from the standpoint of the analysis of the parable to the application of the parable. There are some key elements in the parable I want you to look at. First, there are 10 virgins. By the way, the word here for virgins is commonly used for females. And it has to be understood based on context. There is one case in point in the New Testament where this word is used of males. It's in 2 Corinthians, I believe it's chapter 14, where the Apostle Paul is writing about young virgins who have not given themselves to women. That's what it says. So there, obviously, it means it's referring to men, but the term, as a term, typically meant a woman, a young woman, a maiden, we might call them. And these have a division, and it's an arbitrary division. It could have been 6 and 4, probably. Could have been 7 and 3, but for Jesus' purpose, he used 5 and 5. Other than that, we don't know the meaning of 5 versus 5. Nothing's implied, nothing's suggested by that, other than that is how he divided them. And the bridegroom delays his coming. And you'll find a connection between the bridegroom delaying his coming here and in the previous two lessons that he's taught in chapter 24. There is a delay on the part of the Lord, on the part of the Lord coming. And I'm saying there is a connection, because even in saying there's a connection, we have to be careful. Because there's nothing in this parable that suggests or says or states who the bridegroom is. It is just a parable. And for this sake, it is this use of marriage as a vehicle to get a point across. And the point has little to do with Jesus returning. It has everything to do with our or the audience's readiness. Their readiness. And in this case, we can draw an inference from other passages and other writers. It is the Apostle Paul who introduces the wedding and the bridegroom relative to the end of time and the end of the age. That's who brings that in. And furthermore, we don't know that much about a Palestinian wedding in the first century. We know some things, and the things we know emphatically are very few. There is a passage in 1 Maccabees that refers to some elements of a first century Palestinian wedding. There are some things we can deduce about a first century wedding. We know enough about it to know what a betrothal is, that it was a legal binding relationship. It could only be severed by a legal divorce. It was not the same thing as an engagement, but it was the intention of a full, final consummation, which would be the ultimate marriage. And the marriage was celebrated with a feast. So here's what we've pieced together about a first century Palestinian wedding. And we can't prove any of this. We can only surmise from various writings. The betrothal had taken place. That means there was a contract between the bridegroom and the bride's family, typically her father. There was some kind of an agreement. Many times that agreement meant, what is that called when you have an amount of money that you have to pay? Did you have one? Did any of y'all have to come up with a dowry when you got engaged? In Africa, they still do. In fact, the manager of our manor house, is named Wilford Dawa. And Wilford is engaged. And the engagement will last as long as it takes him to earn 5 cows. He can't get married before that because he hadn't paid his dowry. That's what the father of the bride is charging. So that's certainly not a part of our culture. We're just going to have to imagine that. But once that has been done, once that has been set and the dowry has been paid, then the bridegroom returns or starts work on the home for the couple. And generally it is attached to the father of the groom's home. It's an attachment, either a new building, another property on the property, or just an attachment on the home of the father. So when that construction has taken place and the celebration events for a wedding have been put into place, then the bridegroom gives a notice, "I'm coming for the bride." And at that announcement, the bride begins to assemble her attendants, and the bridegroom assembles his by invitation, by selection. And a part of the work of the attendants was to make the gala brilliant, a great display in public. So when the bridegroom would be on his way from his newly finished home, attached to his father's home, he would send word, "I'm coming." And at that time, the attendants who had made their residence with the bride would light their torches. Now, unfortunately, some English translations translate the word there, lamps. That's an unfortunate translation because there's not one place in the New Testament where this Greek word is translated lamp. It is always translated torch. And the reason torch is to be preferred over lamp is because a lamp was something that was very dim. It was used inside, and it was a dim light that would last forever. It was used simply to accommodate the function of life within the darkness of the home at night. But a torch, was for outside. You wouldn't use a torch inside unless it was a cavernous building. The torch threw off great brilliance, and it was typically at the end of a staff, some rags soaked in oil, and often, if this was a real valid torch, it was made with a cup beneath the rags that the rags were put in. And in order to keep, if you just burned the rags without that cup there, they just instantly burn up. But if you burn them in the oil, they would burn as long as the oil lasted. So, here's what the picture is. The bridegroom has made it known that he's on his way, but he gets delayed. But he said he's on his way, and so the the virgins gather, we're to take this, that they are the attendants of the bride. And they're going to make up a part of the entourage when the bride is introduced to the groom, and together they begin to go to the groom's new home. But they do so with the company of these attendants whose torches light up the darkness of the evening, and with the loud noise and the singing and the trumpet playing, they make their way back to the groom's domicile. Now, as you read through this parable, you discover some things that are just, they're kind of odd. Some translations say that he comes around midnight. You see that? He comes around midnight. That is a pretty good translation, but it's not midnight the time. It's middle of the night. Does that make any sense? Why do we call midnight midnight? Because it used to be in the middle of the night when people went to bed at 8 and got up at 4. But it's no longer what we'd consider the middle of the night, but we still call it midnight. This could have been at any time. But they got up waiting for him to come, ready for him to come. He doesn't come. They're outside, they're on the ground, and lo and behold, they just lay down and go to sleep. And by the way, nothing wrong with that. No condemnation of that. Apparently all 10 of the virgins did that one thing. They went to sleep. And they ought to, because if this is the time he's coming, they're about to be up for a long time. This is going to be a big, long, hairy night. That feast isn't going to be in the middle of the night. It's going to be the next night in the evening. So we got a lot of partying to do. We better get our sleep while we can. So they go to sleep. But he comes. He comes. And when he comes, they wake up and they try to light their torches. And 5 of these don't have any extra oil with them. They're foolish. Matthew makes it clear. They're foolish. And he makes it clear why they're foolish. And one translation uses the word bluntly, they're stupid. And truthfully, they are stupid if they thought that with no oil, they were going to be able to be up that night until he comes, and then to walk through the streets to the new home, and then have the celebration the rest of the night with just the oil that was in their torches. The other virgins knew better. They knew delays can happen. They knew that just because he said he was coming, didn't say when he was coming. They were prepared. They had reserve oil with them. And so when they are awakened by the bridegroom appearing, they do what we would expect. They ask their friends, the other 5 virgins, the wise virgins, for some of their oil. And the wise virgins suggest clearly, hey, if we give you our oil, there won't be enough for any of us. We'll all run out of oil. Go to town and get some oil. Now, who's open in the middle of the night? I don't know. Jesus doesn't say, and I'm not in the first century. So let's just play it forward in this century. They're not going to get any oil till in the morning when the shop opens. We can assume that. That may not be true. Maybe they actually could go get the shopkeeper up. He'd stumble out of bed and answer the door and go to his shop and open his shop and supply them some oil. Maybe they did business that way. In any case, that's not the point. That's not the issue. The issue is they got oil. They returned to the home of the bridegroom. They knock on the door, and the bridegroom himself answers the door. That's peculiar. That's peculiar. Because you would think if it's a celebration, then the bridegroom is a key component to the celebration, someone else would be answering the door. But no, this is the bridegroom. And they, assuming they've been invited, assuming that they had a role in the wedding, and that's something that's important, they had a role in the wedding. The bridegroom says, I don't know who you are. They expected to get in. But he said, I don't know who you are. Now that can be taken a couple of ways. One way is, I can't imagine anybody being at my door at this hour who's not already here. Because everybody who's here had a role and a part in the wedding ceremony. And they've done their part. I don't know who you are. Maybe you didn't want to risk opening the door to some stranger. But what seems more likely is, I don't know who you are because you're not who you were supposed to be. And who you were supposed to be is an attendant as a part of this wedding party doing a role and a part. I don't know who you are. You've sorely disappointed me to the extent I can honestly say, I don't know who you are. That seems to be the most likely interpretation of that phrase. Could he literally have not known who they were? No. No. But with respect to the role they played, yes. Because they were expected to be prepared. That is why they were asked to be a part of the attendance and a part of the party, the wedding party. And they failed that responsibility. So those are the key elements, and I think the meaning of the parable. His comments leading up to this parable are important. Look in verse 42 of chapter 24. Therefore stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have let his house be broken into. Therefore, you must also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Verse 45, who then is the faithful and wise servant, important, whom the master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Is everybody in the kingdom of heaven going to heaven? We've already answered this in previous parables. Is everybody in the kingdom of heaven going to heaven? I'm going to refer you to the wheat and the weeds. He said the kingdom of heaven is like a man who had a field and strangers came in and sowed weeds. You remember that? Shall we pluck them up? What does the landowner say? No. Why not? You'll do damage to the wheat. Don't do that. We'll sort it out in the end. Remember? This is the end. This is the end. That's what the question was about. That's what's important for us to know. That's what Jesus taught. And because of that, I think we need to spend a little less time talking about the who, what, when, where, why, or the who, what, where, when, and answer or address the why, because that's what he's getting at. That's what he focuses on. Nobody knows when. I don't know when, he says. The Son doesn't know. The angels don't know. The Father knows. I don't know when. Here's what's important to know. I am coming. The end is coming. A wise person would be prepared for that. And here in this parable type illustration, I mean, that's what it is, the oil represents the prior preparation. If one really expects the bridegroom to come at any time, they've done their prior preparation. Now, they're in the wedding party, but they don't get into the wedding. This follows and fits perfectly with Jesus' teaching about the variety of people in the kingdom who will not be in heaven. Let's apply it. Let's apply this parable. The citizens of the kingdom are like the virgins waiting for or the bridegroom. Some are wise, some are foolish. The wise people have diligently prepared themselves for the master's coming. They have heeded his call, his call of preparation. They've done what was necessary, and in so doing, they've grown in patience because he doesn't come right away. They notice the delay. Delay's a big part. And by the way, isn't it delay that challenges our patience? Huh? Isn't it the delay that... Do you have a problem with patience? Am I the only one? I have a problem with patience. And you know what? If people would run on my schedule, this world would function much better. Maybe my world would function much better. Let's talk about it. And that's our problem, folks. The problem with our patience has to do with who's at the center of this globe, of this universe. It's not us. And until we move out of the center of this universe and properly project Jesus as the center of this universe, our patience is going to be tried intentionally. It needs to be tried. And for some of us, we have just quit trying. We've just quit taking the test. We are who we are. We say that's how it's going to be. And what Jesus says is very important to people like that. So you've given up, so you've quit growing, so you've stopped maturing. I don't know who you are. I don't know who you are. You say, now wait a minute, Pastor, you're saying they lost their salvation? No. No, I'm not saying anything about their salvation. I'm saying what Jesus says about these virgins. They were invited to the wedding party. They had invitations, probably written in some way, shape, or form. They belonged to the party, but they didn't get in the wedding. They didn't get in. Why? They didn't do their job. They didn't do the thing they were intended to do. Now, I want to tell you something, folks. How do you get into the kingdom of God? How do you get into the kingdom of God? Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I command? Jesus said. How long have we taught that you don't have to do anything to get into the kingdom of God, to get into the family of God? It's all done for you. We've said that, folks. And what we've done is we've misled people to thinking there is no obligation on their part. That's wrong. There is obligation. If you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart, what? What? What is it you're supposed to confess with your mouth and believe in your heart? What is it? Romans chapter 10, verse 9 and 10. You guys know this. That if thou shalt confess with thy mouth and believe in thine heart, that God has raised him from the dead, thou shalt be saved. Confess it with the mouth, believe it with the heart. But what do we ask people to do? Walk down an aisle, sign a card, get baptized, and has nothing to do with acknowledging Christ as Lord. Christ as Lord. Confessing him as Lord is imperative. But equally imperative is serving him as Lord. Jesus makes it clear in the 7th chapter of Matthew that there are a lot of people who claim Lord, Lord, but he doesn't know them. He says, I don't know who you are. I never knew you. I never knew you. But Lord, we've done this and this and this. We've said it. We've said the right things. But obviously they hadn't done the right things. We're not saved by our works. I want you to understand that. We're saved by the gracious work of God, fully and completely. But if our confession is legitimate, then it will be a confession matched by behavior. Is that clear? It will be a confession matched by behavior. I'm following Jesus. Jesus said, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. I guess we could just say to people, that the test of your faithfulness, the test of your genuineness is, are you a fisher of men? Because if you're not a fisher of men, you're not following Jesus. He said, I'll make you that. Now, I'm just using it as one example. There are a number of commandments. There are a number of, in fact, all of the commandments of God are our obligation. Not some, not at our discretion or our will or our election or our choice. All of them. Not only are some wise, but some of these in the kingdom of heaven are foolish. Some of them are foolish. They know the bridegroom is coming. They know that preparation is required. And yet, they don't prepare. And Jesus warns what will happen in such an event. Look in verse 50 and 51. The master of that servant will come one on a day when he doesn't expect him, and in an hour he doesn't know, and will cut him in pieces, and will put him with the hypocrites. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's a description of hell, folks. That's a pretty awful description. Here's another application directly from the story. Nobody can prepare for somebody else. Nobody can prepare for somebody else. Nobody can prepare for you, and you can't prepare for anybody else. The foolish virgins turned to the wise virgins and said, help us. Let your preparation do for us. And they said, no, that can't work that way. Here's another harsh reality, an application. The foolish don't get a second chance. There's no do-overs. Why? Because this is the end. It's the end. There's no end. And then what's that time after the concert's over and they sing that X song? What's that called? A what? An encore? Yeah, there's no encore. There's no encore. And whether Jesus tarries or comes, it's irrelevant. Your time is going to be up. My time is going to be up. I better be prepared for when that time is up, and my time is up right now. I'm looking at it. So, if my time is going to be up, and I know it's going to be up, it's imperative that I be prepared for that, because I don't know when it's going to be up. I don't know what's going to make it be up, except that it will be. So finally, always be prepared. Always be prepared. I want you to know something, folks. This parable doesn't say anything about those foolish virgins, not going to heaven or definitely going to where there's weeping. It doesn't say that. It just says they're not welcomed into the wedding. That being the case, I want to apply this finally to believers. Because maybe it does apply to believers. Maybe it does apply to authentic followers of Jesus Christ. Because even genuine followers of Jesus Christ can give up and get lazy, give up and lose hope, give up and fall back into old ways. Jesus is going to come one of these days. If not for the world, he's going to come for you one of these days. How will he find you? Will he find you fulfilling your duty? Or will he be ashamed and say, I don't know who you are? You call me Lord, but you've given up. You've lost hope. You've quit. You were supposed to be holding a torch, announcing my arrival, celebrating my coming. But instead, your torch went out, and you didn't do anything to relight it. May the Lord find us among the wise. Let's pray together.